Episode 33 with Laura Bikosh.
Where meditation meets daily life, this is the Meditation Freedom Podcast.
Thank you so much for tuning into the Meditation Freedom Podcast. My name is Sika Rode, and this podcast is about meditation and mindfulness, how we bring that into our daily lives and why we do it. And in this podcast, I interview people from all walks of life who have integrated mindfulness and meditation into their daily lives. And it's really interesting to listen to each of their stories and to see how they apply the wisdom and compassion that they learn through practice into their particular lives and their particular careers. And it's just wonderful to see that. Now, last week we talked with Alan Brown about mindfulness in schools using the program he uses as Mindful Schools. But I wanted to give one more point of view, and so that you as the listener can see that there are other organizations doing wonderful things as well about bringing mindfulness and meditation in schools. So today I'm going to be interviewing Laura Bikosh. And with Laura, I wanted to talk specifically about reactive behaviors as well, destructive emotions. So you'll get a slightly different view from last week. Now, Laura obtained her PhD in transpersonal psychology from Sophia University and has spent more than 5 years researching the academic and behavioral effects of mindful awareness practices on children in K through 12 schools. And she also worked for 20 years in large multinational companies, including Northern Telecom, EMC, and GE. And you'll hear her talk a little bit about her experience with GE and bringing mindfulness in this corporation. Laura's had a mindful awareness practice for more than 20 years. And as you'll hear, she'll talk a little bit about how she started sharing her practice with her fellow employees back when she worked with GE. And then at some point, she realized with the many positive results that she saw in her daily practice on her performance, her creativity, and well-being, she realized she wanted to bring that into education and bring that to a much younger audience. So at that point, she co-founded a program called Inner Explorer with her childhood friend Janice Houlihan. And Inner Explorer's vision is to inspire people to develop a daily mindfulness awareness practice, leading to a more compassionate, joyful, healthful, loving, and peaceful world. And they accomplish this by providing this program to schools for children and their families worldwide. And they say that this practice will help lead the children and teens towards their highest potential by bolstering academic performance, creativity, social and emotional aptitude, and well-being. So with that, let's get right into the interview with Laura Bikosh. Thank you so much, Laura, for joining me on this podcast.
Oh, my pleasure.
So I would love to know how you got started with meditation and a little bit about your journey into meditation and mindfulness.
Okay. So I came to it probably like many people as a way to manage stress. Back in, I guess, 1994, I was working for GE in their healthcare division, and I was traveling quite a bit for work. And, you know, GE at that time, like a lot of corporations, very, you know, demanding and lots of, lots of long hours and things like that. And I just was finding that I was feeling really stressed out pretty often and sort of reactive as a result of that. I just wasn't, you know, sleeping as well and wasn't eating as well and just was starting to feel like I was unraveling a little bit. And so I had been reading quite a bit about mindfulness and about meditation and about different ways that people were, you know, relieving stress. And I thought, oh, I should probably check this out. So I read a couple of books. I read, you know, Kabat-Zinn's book, Wherever You Are. There You Are. I think it's Wherever You
Yeah.
Now I can't remember the name of the book. Wherever you are, there you are, something like that. But anyway,
right.
It was one of his initial books, and found that really kind of incredibly eye-opening. And so then I went to a retreat for a weekend to kind of learn more about it and to learn kind of the strategy on how to meditate and what was it all about. And so that was kind of the very beginning of the odyssey. I got really committed to practicing every day and started to notice lots of positive changes. You know, in my life, I was feeling better. I was sleeping better. I was much more level when, you know, the chaos of the work life was coming at me.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course of a couple of years, I went to a few more training classes, felt like I was getting a little bit deeper in my understanding, and I was continuing to practice every day. And probably several years into this, and I ended up moving into a different role at GE and was at the headquarters facility, and I was traveling at that point through the Americas. And people would ask me all the time, you know, why is it that you seem pretty calm, pretty level, even though, you know, there's so much going on? And for quite a long time, I didn't admit what I was doing. I just said, oh, you know, just working out and stuff.
Right.
And finally, enough people sort of were asking, and I was really feeling like it was such a positive thing in my life that I thought, okay, maybe now is the time to share this. So with my direct team, I brought in a trainer, and we did a weekend retreat with, I don't know, I think at the time it was close to 50 people.
Wow.
And we had an MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction teacher, come in, and she did this program, and then she provided tools to the team, did weekly call-ins. She gave them practice tapes to listen to. It was on tape at that point. And we found it within that year. So we changed a bunch of things about how I ran the business also, that business unit that I was in charge of. And we found that the employees felt better, performed better, had higher sense of loyalty, higher sense of connection with each other, and it really kind of transformed the entire team.
Wow.
So the next year,
and
we
what year was
that,
this, by the way? Just to,
so this was 2001.
Okay, yeah. So we're still really new at that time.
Yep. So, and I, you know, like I said, I had a bunch of years under my belt at that point, and was feeling like, okay, this really could help people, you know, manage stress and feel better. So the next year, the same trainer came in, she did another program. And by then, a lot of other people within GE had heard about what we were doing. And we had a number of people ask if they could join the group for the next session. And we kind of did the same thing. We did a 2.5 day retreat, and we ended up with maybe close to 100 people at that session.
Wow.
And, you know, same kinds of outcomes that following year. Just, it felt like sort of, you know, you're operating on all cylinders, right, to use an analogy. And at the very same time, there was a high-level research going on at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which was right down the street from where GE Healthcare was headquartered. And Richard Davidson and his lab were doing all of that groundbreaking functional MRI research on the Buddhist monks, showing brain changes associated with these kinds of practices. And GE, incidentally, made those functional MRI made that equipment, so there was a kind of a nice tie-in, because all of us at headquarters were kind of watching that research pretty closely. And it was then that I realized, you know, a couple of things. One, it's really hard for people to practice every day. You know, we all go to a seminar and it's great, and then oftentimes we don't really integrate it. So luckily for me, with my team, we could put some things into place as we run the business to help people remember to practice all the time. But in a lot of the people that joined that second session with me, they went back to teams that didn't integrate it. And so it just got left, you know, and wasn't pursued.
Right.
So, what I realized at that time was that the regular practice was really critical to achieving sort of these beautiful health and well-being benefits.
Right.
And that if we could teach people when they were young, they could develop the habit that would be extremely useful while they're young, but also throughout their whole life. So I decided to leave GE at that time. I went and became an MBSR teacher. So I went through the UMass teacher training program, and I went to grad school to study the impact in education. So I wanted to look a little bit more closely to some of the things that we were seeing in adults. Was that transferable to children?
Mm-hmm.
And then the practices themselves, you know, how do you make those practices that were really designed for adults applicable for kids? So I left GE in 04 and went and did, you know, a bunch of training and started teaching in after-school programs and in schools in my community when I lived in the Midwest. And then in 2011, I co-founded Inner Explorer as a way to kind of operationalize this, as a way to bring these practices into K-12 schools so that they could develop a daily practice, again, that would help them, you know, in school and in life.
Right. And before we get more into the school part, I'm curious about the struggles you experienced at GE, because you already said they were somewhat health-related and they were connected to the University of Wisconsin. So you already had some alliances or people that were supportive of that, but you ran into struggles with integrating, you said earlier?
Yeah, so kind of what the key thing that I would like to, you know, sort of get across is that some learning, you can just go to a seminar and get the information, and then it's kind of part of what you know and what you understand.
Mm-hmm.
But with mindfulness, it's really, really critical that you practice every day.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can go to a seminar and understand the background and understand what it's about and why it might be useful in your life. But if you don't do it every day, you don't really get any benefit. And it's similar, as some researchers have said, it's kind of like brushing your teeth. You know, you can go to a seminar and learn all about dental health.
Right.
But if you don't brush your teeth every day, it's, you know, it's not going to matter. And this is kind of a similar thing with cognitive health. So at GE, when I had a, you know, my direct team that worked in my organization could be supported in their efforts to practice all the time. So they had tapes that they could play. We had two different points during the week that we had check-ins. And so we kind of kept it front and center in people's minds. Not that we mandated that everybody meditate every day, but we encouraged them to dig in as it felt comfortable for them so that they could, you know, understand it better from an embodied standpoint.
Right.
You know, from a practice standpoint. And as they did that, they found that it was very useful in their lives too. And so they actually really embraced it. But I think if you don't have that kind of structure in your life, it's really hard to fit it in, you know?
Right.
So we were saying, hey, fit it in during your workday. That's okay with us. It's that important. But most, you know, workdays at that time anyway, didn't have, you know, an acceptable thing that, oh, go and meditate for a half hour during the workday.
Well, and so, they don't even have a room to do that oftentimes or place
exactly,
to do that.
Yeah. Exactly. So when more people joined because they sort of saw what was happening and were hearing what was happening, they went back into different parts of the organization that didn't have all the structures in place to support them. And so it kind of fell off because they just, you know, most of them weren't able to keep up with it. So as far as a daily practice. And I find, you know, when I talk to people, I taught adults, I've taught children. And when I talk to adults, especially, you know, so many people want to do these kinds of practices because they understand that it could help in their lives. But fitting it in is supremely difficult.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the other reason that we, you know, started the company or the organization, because they're 10-minute audio-guided, you know, tracks, And so the teacher can just press play on the record on the classroom computer. Everybody listens together. It's only 10 minutes, so it's pretty easy to fit in. And they learn as a group, and then they're off and running. So we've tried to make it simple.
Yes, so basically what you're saying is this program that you created with Inner Explorer is a set of videos on a CD or something that the teachers all the way from kindergarten all the way to high school, right? All the way to the end of high school.
Yes.
And then they can play that. When do they play that? How does that work?
Yeah, so basically the program is set up so that they're audio guided. And actually the very first thing that the recording says is closing your eyes, because we want them to be going inward. And each one is 10 minutes long. There's each grade level, or let's say each segment, because there's a pre-KK program, there's an elementary, there's a middle, and a high school. And so each of those four has a series of 90 separate tracks. Each track's about 10 minutes, although the pre-KK is 5 minutes for the younger kids. And the teachers can select when the right time is in their day to play it. So we generally encourage the teachers to consider when would be the most useful time in the day to re-engage the kids. So a lot of times that's right after lunch, or sometimes it's first thing in the morning, right when the students get into class. Sometimes if in the elementary grades, it's after recess when they're trying to re-engage them into learning. So it depends, and it's flexible. So mm-hmm. The program is streamed into the classroom. So the teachers just, you know, go onto the website and log in.
Yeah, so it's online. That's pretty easy. So no fussing with CDs and stuff.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep. And we encourage the teachers to participate with the students so that they get a chance to spend 10 minutes a day kind of regrounding themselves. And the teachers consistently report to us that it's their favorite time of the day, because they get to just settle.
I believe it, yeah.
Teachers today are facing enormous challenges. I mean, they have 25-plus kids coming at them, and kids today have higher levels of stress, higher levels of anxiety. There's higher levels of poverty. I mean, there's a lot of trauma that the teachers need to face every single day with a lot of the children that are in their classes. And that's, you know, imagine, right, that coming at you every single day. So this gives them a chance to just kind of resettle and meet the day, you know, with even more sort of resilience and care.
And do you find that in some cases where teachers turn it on when the group level of anxiety or whatever, if they're all riled up for some reason or another, that they just go, okay, now is a good time for us to take that time out?
Yep. Definitely. And it seems like, you know, it's a little bit different with each different teacher, but generally what we're finding is that they'll pick a time that is pretty typically a time that's difficult to get the students reengaged. Mm-hmm. And then they'll stick with that time. And then the students become very knowledgeable that, okay, this is when we do Inner Explorer. So, you know, they'll come in from lunch or whatever and sit right down and get going. So, and, you know, students, sometimes it takes them a little bit longer to get settled. It really just depends on the student. But overall, within, you know, the first week or two, students will start asking for it as well, because it feels good. You know, students are generally closer to that state anyway, you know, of being fully mindful. Mm-hmm. They kind of operate in the moment pretty often. But they don't operate in an inward sense. So even though kids are in their moment, they're not usually digging in to understand what's going on in their inner world. Right. And once they start doing that, they realize it feels pretty good, you know, to kind of notice, for instance, thoughts and emotions coming and going. They start to disconnect from the sense that they are their anger or they are their frustration. They see anger and frustration sometimes coming and going. So it's really healthy for them to, separate the thought and the thinker.
Right. And so in the meditation audio, do you put like some guided meditation so that the students learn to see that difference between the anger and, identifying with their anger?
Yes, that's a great question. I should have pointed out. So the program follows the mindfulness-based stress reduction protocol. So in the adult world, that's the program that's been here very, very well studied for the past 35 years or so. That was the UMass program that Jon Kabat-Zinn and colleagues developed. And so it's been, very well received, very, very well researched. And so we've taken that protocol and we've created these 90 sort of bite-sized pieces. So yes, the program is guided. The program each day provides different instruction. It builds just like MBSR builds. So it starts out with things like awareness of breathing and, relaxation. It moves to physical senses, then to thought, then to emotions, then to connection and compassion. So, as kids become more skilled at attending and focusing their attention, they can do it for longer and they can handle more complicated ideas, like noticing emotions come up, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And what's been remarkable, lots of things have been remarkable, but what on this topic, children start to practice what it feels like to be angry. So they recall a time in recent memory that they were really angry about something, as an example. And they notice the bodily sensations of that emotion. And so as they practice those kinds of things throughout the series, they become really familiar with how anger comes up for them. And so oftentimes when any of us gets angry, we react. Right. However, we've always reacted is what we normally keep doing.
Right.
And in this case, as kids practice, they have that momentary awareness of, oh, that's anger. I recognize that sensation. And that little bit of pause is what gives them a chance to respond and, and to kind of bring that prefrontal cortex thinking brain back online.
Right. And that de-escalates it.
Exactly. So we've done a bunch of research and others have replicated that students have 50% reduction in their behavior problems. So fewer kids are getting sent to the principal's office, fewer incidences of bullying, fewer suspensions, fewer detentions, that kind of thing. And kids do better in school as a result as well. So higher grades, higher test scores, really pretty amazing improvements with a 10-minute a day intervention. That's pretty cost effective.
That is amazing. Yeah. And so this research, this is like you researched it with a group of students over an entire semester, or how did you do that?
Yep. So there were actually three different research studies conducted, a total of about 1,000 children altogether. There was an 8-week study, which was about a semester. There was a 10-week study, just a little bit longer, and then a 27-week study, which was, the first quarter of that study was the precondition. And then as soon as the first quarter ended, the intervention started. And then for the next three quarters, the students went through the intervention. And then the fourth quarter grades, that was the post condition. So the first study was controlled, which just means that there were some children that participated and some children didn't. The second and the third study were randomized controlled, which just means that out of all the teachers that volunteered to participate, those volunteers were randomized into either the intervention or the control condition. Mm-hmm. So randomization is just considered kind of the gold standard in research. It's, you have more faith in those results because the teachers didn't pick to do it or not do it. They all picked that they wanted to do it, and then you randomized.
One of the, as you mentioned already, one of the effects of this mindfulness practice is a 50% reduction in bullying. And you had an interesting article, I think, in Mindful Magazine that talked about how the programs with bullying haven't really worked well in the past because it was all about an intellectual understanding of bullying. So the kids kind of know the difference intellectually, but there was no physical or emotional knowing. And so there was a gap between the knowing and the doing or understanding. Maybe you can explain a little bit more about that.
Yeah, and that's kind of what we were saying about, you know, you can go to the seminar, you can read the book, you know, check the box, but it doesn't mean that you're really embodying that. And so what's amazing about mindfulness is that there have been a number of studies that have shown that people that practice have greater sense of self-awareness, greater sense of resilience, and a greater sense of compassion. So those are all well-documented outcomes. Mm-hmm. And if you consider in the bullying triad, you know, there's the bully, there's the victim, and oftentimes there are witnesses.
Bystanders.
And so, same. So in those three categories, if you think about it, if all the children are practicing mindfulness or mindful awareness, the bully, or we'll start with the victim. So, you know, there's a whole profile on what victims are typically like and why they're not standing up for themselves. But, you know, oftentimes they're outside of the school norms. And so these practices help those children become more resilient. So, and what that means is that they are less likely to become a target, that they are more likely to ask for help when they need it, and those two things alone start to shift the dynamic, right? A lot of times today, the victims will suffer in silence,
right?
They don't think they deserve to get help. They think they do deserve to be bullied.
And they believe the story that they're not deserving,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And so those children, through these practices, start to become aware of their gifts. They start to become aware of what they are from a really deep and profoundly human level, right?
That's wonderful.
They are not their story anymore. They are not what is being said about them anymore. They are something completely different, and they start to be able to touch into that place. And as a result, they develop a sense of resilience, and then they start acting a little bit differently, right? They're not going to be the easy target. So the bystander in general, 90% of bystanders say that they think bullying is wrong and that they would intervene. And yet only about 11% of children actually do intervene.
Because they're really scared to do that, yeah.
Exactly. It's a fight, flight, freeze kind of response, right? When you're in the middle of that chaotic, you know, exchange, they don't want to get bullied. A lot of kids are just nervous. They don't know what to do, even though, you know, they'll report that they know what to do. They'll report that they don't like bullying. But when push comes to shove and they're in that environment, they don't always act. But with mindfulness, there's tons of research that shows children become, or that people become, more compassionate. And in fact, the compassionate sense in the, you know, the place in the brain where compassion, you know, is said to reside, becomes more active. And there have been a couple studies that show that people actually act more compassionately, even to people that they don't know, as a result of doing these practices. And so then you end up with bystanders that are much more inclined to engage, to help, and that, you know, have this growing sense of compassion that even if they don't intervene in the middle of that exchange, they're more willing to, you know, touch base with that victim on the side and at least, you know, give a word of support or maybe get somebody else involved that needs to be there to help.
Yeah. And what I'm thinking about too, as you're saying this, is that they're putting themselves a little bit on the side too and seeing something larger than themselves. And therefore there's an enlargement of self idea involved there too.
Right. You're absolutely right. And some of these things, I mean, when kids practice these kinds of, mindfulness on a regular basis, they shift. I mean, not all of it is neatly isolated in, you know, the research studies that have been done, but you can also see it. You can see the shift in the kids that become, you know, more engaged with each other, more willing to lend a hand, and those kinds of things.
Because that takes courage to not worry about just your little self, but also to worry about somebody else.
Exactly. And even though I'm isolating the, you know, resilience and awareness and compassion by person in the bullying triad, all of the people in the triad are developing all of those skills as a result of these practices. So the bystanders are also becoming more resilient, more willing, you know, to not let, you know, situations put them down.
Right.
And then the last person in the triad is the bully. And, you know, as we see it, if nothing else, you know, bullies have all kinds of complicated situations in their background, which often is what propels them into that role to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And so the practices, the very foundation of it is awareness. And sometimes the bullies are just so disconnected from what their actions are causing,
right,
especially with, you know, online bullying and, you know, cyberbullying and so on, that a developing sense of awareness of their own actions are bound to just connect them at a different level with their victim. So they're going to be able to, you know, understand my actions have a consequence, and that, you know, they'll start to tune into that even more so. So those, at least from our experience, those are kind of the things that impact those different players. And we've seen in lots of classrooms the number of bullying incidences go way, way down.
And
it's funny because
one
last comment. When I was at GE, which is sort of funny, the team initially had some bullying going on.
The adults.
Yep. And, you know, there's sort of this cat fighting and, you know, this one doesn't do this and backstabbing. And I mean, that's not unusual in a corporate environment. And what ended up, you know, fast forward 3 years later, when we were well into this, this kind of practice, it all changed. This was a cohesive, highly loyal, connected team. And in fact, it's funny because that team is still known as the dream team from an internal perspective. So after I left and, you know, all kinds of different things shifted, but people would say, oh my gosh, we got to get the dream team back together. The business hasn't been the same since, you know, this thing kind of disbanded. So, and we see that in classrooms that, you know, the teacher and the students become this connected, cohesive unit.
That's wonderful. Yeah, because especially now, you know, it's been another school shooting, and I'm sure whenever somebody listens to this a year later, there'll be a few more that have happened. But, you know, with the school shootings, those are basically, the perpetrator is somebody who's very disconnected, alienated, you know, probably doesn't feel like nobody cares about them. And so they seek this attention in a very negative way. And I can just see how your programs like yours would do the same thing, would de-escalate and would make that person feel more connected rather than less connected.
Yeah. I have a story that's so relevant with here in Florida. There's an organization called Girls Inc., and they're an after-school program for, you know, at-risk girls. And they are wonderful. They teach leadership, they teach finance, they teach, you know, all kinds of technology. And the idea is to give these children a chance, right, at having a better life. And there was a girl that had been going to Girls Inc. for maybe 5 years. And the executive director told me the story when I was in there. They had been running our program for maybe 8 weeks. And, you know, it was going real well. And she said, "You won't even believe what happened." She said, "This girl who has been here for 5 years, it has been so difficult. She's violent. She's mean. She steals. You know, she's angry. She's unhelpful. She is literally the antithesis of what we try to promote in this organization. But we would never give up on a child. So we meet as a staff, and we have been for years, every 2 or 3 weeks to try to figure out some new way to reach this child." They said she's from a very difficult home life. Both of her parents are in jail. She lives with her aunt, who is a known drug abuser and diabetic, and she has all kinds of other health issues. And this girl is just, challenged, to say the least. Mm-hmm. And she said that this morning, so I was there physically at the facility, and she said, "Just this morning, I was reading the Girl of the Month awards. We give a Girl of the Month every month. And I was reading through, and this young girl was voted unanimously Girl of the Month this month. And she said, as I read through the comments of the staff and the students, she said, I couldn't even believe what I was reading. They said she's helpful, she's kind, she goes out of her way, she's quick to laugh. And the woman, the executive director, looked at me and she said, "It's as if she found herself for the first time." Mm-hmm. At almost 12 years old.
And this was after how long?
Eight
was
weeks.
She? 8 weeks of
eight weeks of
practicing.
Yep.
Meditation.
Yep. Every day, for 5 days a week when she was there, and that's not unusual. That is what we hear all the time, because children that are from those really, really challenging environments, they don't know how to process what's happening to them, and we can't even really fathom half the time what is happening to them, right? Yeah. We don't know, but they don't have the tools, and they don't know where to turn, right? A lot of times the people that are in charge of taking care of them aren't, and so they don't know what to do. And so it comes out in all of these behaviors. And when you give them the chance to kind of dig in deeply into whatever their essence is, most often what's there is really good.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they just have to tap into that and start to trust that that's there.
Mm-hmm.
And then they start to emerge from a whole different place. Like, they emerge from this beautiful, amazing place. And then they're unstoppable. They become, these forces of, of good, positive momentum. And I'm telling you, we see this all the time.
Yeah, that's amazing. So talk about transformation of a bully into a force of good. Yeah.
Exactly. But I keep saying that it's the regular practice that's so important. And once they get that habit, it's fantastic. And they know, they love it. They're like, "We need to do an explorer today. How come we haven't done it yet?" But it takes a little bit of time to get, to develop the practice.
Yeah. What, in terms of how much time would that take? Have you kind of have some idea of what that involves?
We have a sense, broadly, the littler kids, the pre-KK and the elementary, within a week and a half, you're done. Kids love it. Everybody's happy. It's not that hard. And the teacher just, hits the button and goes. And it's easy to fit in those age ranges because the kids are in the same room usually throughout the day. And so the teacher can kind of fit it in at whatever point. In the older grades, the middle and the high school, there's two things. One is that it's harder to fit into the day because a lot of times they're moving from subject to subject, and each subject is only 45 or 55 minutes, so fitting in 10 minutes is kind of tough.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes they'll do it in the beginning of the day, kind of at the, some schools have like a homeroom type thing or a study hour or study time that the kids can do it. So that's one thing that's a little bit harder. The other thing is that those ages, it takes them a little bit longer to dig in, you know. So it might take 3 weeks before they really get the sense that this is helping them. You know, at first it's like, hey, why are we doing this? This is kind of stupid. I don't feel any different, you know.
Right.
So we work hard through the scripting to help with the relevance piece, but we also guide the teachers, like, don't give up, just keep going for a couple weeks and you'll get there. And then those students get really deeply engaged in it because they really can feel, they'll be able to feel the difference pretty profoundly.
Right. And if they were already doing it in grades earlier, then the transition is even smoother, right?
Definitely.
Yeah. And have you, do you by any chance know if once they leave school, if they still continue to do it, or?
So that's a really great question, and we don't know for sure. We know a couple of things. One, we know that 40 to 50% of the students bring the practices home and teach somebody in their household, which is pretty amazing, right?
Yeah, that's great.
So they can see the stress that families are under, not just families in poverty, like all families have lots of stress. And so they bring it home and they teach their siblings or their parents. So that's pretty awesome. And we have lots of students ask us if we can create an at-home program for them and for their family to do at home. And we're working on that, but
that's
it's
great.
Not done yet. Yeah. And I think, you know, ideally what we try to do through the program is we try to give them the skills and the tools. So, you know, our program is nice and easy. It's 10 minutes. It's guided. It's great. But also we mentioned throughout the series, hey, you can do this at home. You know, try this at home, try that at home, because we want them to understand they don't need the guidance. Once they get really good at it, they may not want the guidance. They may want to just sit and do some of the practices on their own.
That's
which
great.
Is perfect, you know, we're perfectly happy with that. In fact, we'd love for every child every day throughout their K-12 years to do these practices. We think, you know, the world would change.
Yeah, that's great. So where do you see this in 5 to 10 years from now? Because we just talked about how it could resolve one of the problems that people are talking all about, controlling violence and mental institutions, but this program to me sounds like a much more taking care of the root problem.
I know. I just, you know, so what would be fantastic for us is to just have the awareness, you know, of educators and even of parents. So we're so happy to, you know, be doing this interview with you because we know that this is what helps build awareness.
Mm-hmm.
That programs like this, ours and others, are pretty cost effective, very easy to implement, and can literally transform classrooms and schools. And we ought to be doing this everywhere today. There's no reason why every school in the United States doesn't run a program like this. It's not just the academic improvements that have been shown. It's not even just the behavior improvements, but there's also health and well-being improvements. So these practices improve, you know, that they reduce depression, they reduce anxiety, they improve all kinds of mental health issues. You know, it's been documented. So you kind of say, gosh, we have a lot of kids I think it's like 1 in 5 kids has a mental health disorder that inhibits their ability to succeed in school.
Yeah,
like, my goodness,
tragic.
Right? Yeah. Kids today report so much stress, which is linked to all kinds of other disease states and immune system dysfunction. This stuff is kind of simple, and yet, you know, I don't know what we're all waiting for. But so in our plan, we're trying to reach 1 million children by 2019. So we have served close to 15,000 so far that are practicing every day, which is awesome.
Awesome.
And we hope by 2019 we have that number to 1 million or more. I mean, there's 55 million kids in this country. Like, that's, we're not doing it fast enough, but we're not sure how to do it faster yet. It's all about, you know, funding and all that kind of stuff. But we're we're working all those pieces.
Yeah, I think it just needs to hit critical mass and then it'll go really quickly.
I think you're exactly right. And we're working on, you know, our systems, you know, to make sure, because like I said, it's just streaming, you log in, it's pretty easy. So we're working on just making sure that those systems are robust enough and that the cost, you know, the price point per classroom is low enough that it's a very strong value proposition for schools and that we're ready when they're ready.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's just like coming back to your work situation where at GE, where an employer sees, hey, if I do this, I end up saving, you know, X amount of time of sick leave. So it's a no-brainer that I spend a little bit of money on this mindfulness program in order to save X amount of dollars on the sick leave.
Exactly.
Or other problems.
And you think, like, as a country, if every kid was doing this every day, because, like, workplace initiatives are hard. It's still hard to get people to do this every day,
right.
As you probably know.
Yep.
So if we get these, you know, children to do this every day through school, you know, we've improved the likelihood that the habit will be developed and will be solid
right.
by the time they're adults. And you won't even need a workplace program because it'll already be done.
Right. Yeah, you know? Exactly. One generation, so, hopefully, from now.
And that, you know what? That's a perfect thing to say because we feel the same way. You know, we could change things in one generation.
Yeah, I believe it.
So it's very exciting, though. It's the most exciting work I loved my time at GE. I think it's just a phenomenal company. This work sort of speaks to my soul and is kind of the next projection out.
Well, this has been great. Thank you so much for sharing what wonderful things you're doing with your partner.
Yes, Janice Houlihan, yes.
Janice as well. I'm definitely going to be also looking forward to seeing a million kids do it in a couple more years.
Beautiful. And thank you so much for doing this interview and for getting the word out. We really appreciate you and the work you're doing, and you know, hopefully together we can keep this momentum going.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this interview with Laura Bikash of Inner Explorer. You can find out more about Laura and the program by going to meditationfreedom.com/033. And as always, please, if you have any comments or further questions, please leave those on the show notes in the comments area, and I'll make sure that either Laura or myself will get back to you and respond. And of course, I would encourage you, especially if you're a parent or if you know some parents with kids, to contact your school and see if you can get a mindfulness program in your school. I think it's a no-brainer, and everybody should strongly consider convincing your school to bring a mindfulness program. And if you know of any other great programs, feel free to let me know as well, and maybe I can bring another guest on at some point and talk about this particular topic some more. And I wanted to do a quick shout out to Luis Cannon from Australia. Thanks so much for your wonderful note on the show notes. I really appreciate comments. It's wonderful to get to know some of the folks who are listening. So thanks again. Well, I wish you a wonderful rest of your week and a great evening or morning wherever you are. Take care.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Meditation Freedom Podcast, where meditation meets daily life.